Mini episode 447 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, and we have a very special edition of the FDH Lounge coming at you today. And that term, I'm sure, will have very, very special resonance with the gentleman who is coming on with us. That's a special part of TV parlance when they start talking about a very special episode of something. But our good friend Adam Buckman, FDH Lounge dignitary, somebody who has been a part of our crew over a period of time and also with us in the 21st Century Media Alliance, long-time TV critic and columnist, long-time TV editor of the New York Post, and specifically about that era. His memoirs have just emerged this summer. You can find them on Amazon.com. Jerk, How I Wasted My Life Watching Television, his book. And a very an interestingly titled book because, again, for anyone who knows Adam, he is anything but a jerk. And, again, as we with the show and in the 21st Century Media Alliance have found him to be somebody who is very gracious with those who are less experienced than he and less accomplished at this point than he, and somebody who really is good to people and is willing to share of his expertise with them. But then again, that wouldn't make for such great marketing for the book. I understand the route that this was taken, and it was embraced very joyously here as far as, and we'll get to this, as far as some of the hate mail that was in there, and a very entertaining image that he chose to go with. But been looking forward to doing this for a while, ever since a long time ago when I first found out that this memoir was in the works. It is finally out. I've really enjoyed reading it, and it is so great to get on the show, as I said, our friend Adam Buckman. Adam, welcome back to the show, my friend. How are you today?
I'm just fine, Rick. It's really great to be talking to you again. It's been way too long. And
yes.
I love the opening of your show, you know, the origin story of FDH Lounge. I never grow tired of hearing that. It's fantastic.
Ah, thank you so much. Yes, from the humble environs back in late 2006, talking in a parking lot in Cleveland, Ohio, with my co-founder Jason Jones, to what we have gotten to almost 450 mini episodes later, plus 152 full-length episodes. You've been a part of both eras of the show, and it's been really wonderful getting to talk to you over a period of time. And again, been really looking forward to doing this ever since I found out that it was in the works. And again, I know that to get to a little bit of backstory on this, you and I had some conversations. And again, these are
you and I have talked about this for a while. You know,
we had, I to pull back the curtain a little bit, it's something that you at one point at least weren't completely convinced you were going to go through with. And again, I kind of feel vindicated because I'd seen the excerpts of it, and I said, oh, it's going to be great. What are you talking about? So what was the thought as you were going through on this about finally committing to it, putting it all down and putting it out there? What was going through your head?
I guess it's a writer's exercise with writer's reluctances, if that's a word, that are probably not uncommon to people who find themselves writing, you know, a book-length piece. Certainly a book. It's the first one I ever wrote, and I'm so accustomed to writing, you know, for newspapers and websites where the deadline is in a couple of hours and you finish your work and you're done for the day, and then you start over the next day. To have a project, a writing project, sort of stick around for what turned into about 3 or 4 years is something that was just unusual for me. And there were times when I thought even I didn't really know where the book was going. It wasn't like I outlined some sort of story in detail in order to have a beginning, middle, of an end. It's very organic like that. And at times I got busy, as you know. I spent a couple years as a web editor with the Comcast people, and I wound up sort of putting the book on hold for a while. But what happened was that job dissolved last winter, and I suddenly had time to say, you know what, I'm going to take the months of January and February and bang out the final two chapters of this thing if it kills me. And it didn't kill me. It actually brought the book around to where, to me, it finally made sense. So that's, I guess, the not that unusual evolution of a book. You know, it sort of fits and starts, and finally it's out. And we have the ability today to self-publish. So that's what I did on Amazon as an Amazon e-book, just to see if there'd be interest. And there has been some, and it's been very gratifying.
That's tremendous. I'm glad to hear that, because it definitely is a book that deserves an audience, a book that is really entertaining cover to cover, again, with your interactions with some of the greats of TV and some of the, I don't know if we'd call them the greats of pop culture, but the biggest names, I suppose, for good, for bad, for indifferent, the biggest names that we've had out there really in the last quarter century plus. What I thought was very interesting, going from your cover and then subsequently into the book here, the embrace of the whole hate mail motif. Mm-hmm. And again, not everything that you're putting in there is hate mail. There are some things that are just, I guess, kind of strange or just things that people were sending you. But as far as, I've been laughing, telling some of my friends about this, like Adam must have hung on to every piece of hate mail that he ever got. So how did you basically, how did you have all of this in the first place? Were you socking all of this away over the years?
I was, and it's a little unusual for me personally because I'm a very organized person and I don't like clutter and I tend to throw things away. And not save things, you know, through the years. But for whatever reason, I became kind of a relentless self-archivist, you might say. It doesn't take up that much space, but it is true that I possess 18 loose-leaf notebooks of reader mail that I received when I was, principally when I was TV columnist of the New York Post for 10 years, about 1998 to 2008. And I guess I began to keep it because the mail kind of originates in the era of real mail, you know, where people would really write you letters in envelopes and they would be anonymous and you'd get your mail in the morning and it would be a lot of press releases and press kits from TV networks, but tucked in there would be like some crazy letter. And so I couldn't resist those. And so eventually it all evolved or became email, and I did go through an exercise of keeping emails, particularly when I would get a flood of them for a particular column or story. And so with these materials, I was able to recreate in the book of the chapter one, which is titled Sticks and Stones, the sort of experience of being a public opinion giver, you know, in a rollicking tabloid like the New York Post, and what happens when basically, you know, because when you think about it, Rick, maybe you've had this experience being in radio, but you know, the people who are going to take pains to write to you are the ones who are going to be the most passionate about whatever you wrote. And, you know, most people who read your column, they're just neutral about it. They read it. They might not like it. They might disagree. But then they go on with their life. But the people who really put pen to paper and bang it out and mail it to you, they're the ones who are going to be unglued. And they're just priceless. They're just fantastic, you know.
They really are. And, you know, in reading it, you know, everything that you, the way that you lay it out, everything is either, I would say, dispassionately presented or humorously presented. But I have to ask you, I mean, was there any of that that ever got to you? Was there ever any of it where it legitimately hurt your feelings or made you feel sad or mad or scared or anything like that?
You don't really
give any sense of that.
No, you don't, because you just... You just become so used to being out there. I worked at a desk high up in an office building. It wasn't like anyone was going to come up and attack me. And if I went outside, despite the fact that the newspaper column had a small photo of me on it, I found that, you know, hardly anybody ever recognized me from it. You know, they don't really see that, oh, there's that guy from the Post walking down the street. So you feel kind of safe like that. And nobody ever said, you know, I mean, they might have called me every name in the book, such as Jerk, which is where the title of the book comes from. But no one ever really threatened to take my head off as soon as I walked out of the building, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, yeah, I guess there were times when I was grateful that I have, you know, in my home an unlisted phone number and therefore people couldn't really find out where I lived. I mean, I don't know if anyone would have been unglued enough to come and confront me in my apartment house or something, but no, I never got that way. And it's interesting. You know, I even make this point in the book where we would get, you know, we, my colleagues and I would get this mail from people who would write all kinds of racist, disgusting, homophobic stuff. And we would just kind of laugh at it, kind of be disgusted. My coworkers would throw it away. I'd save it. But you know, when other people like Columbia University professors get something in the mail with, like, you know, a swastika on it or something, they call the police and the police launch an investigation. And, you know, none of it, and this never occurred to any of us.
You know, you're just going, yeah, that's my readership.
Exactly. It was like, well, this is the Post, whatever. You know, it just never occurred to me that there'd be any danger. Look, in my heart of hearts, yeah, sure, I thought it was sad to get something from someone who was mental. And yes, I wondered where they were when they wrote these letters. Were they at home angrily scribbling it out? Or I don't know what they were doing. Some of them were collages and things. You know, you get all this weird stuff. Anyway, I put that chapter first to kind of whet the appetite for the whole book, kind of set the stage for what it's like. And I felt that it worked, and a lot of people liked that chapter a lot.
Yeah, it seemed like it really did work in that way, and it does set you up for what's to come for anybody that reads the book. I wonder also, too, if it was a little bit easier to kind of take that a little bit more relaxed attitude to it in terms of you get the sense reading the book, and again, as I say, you're in a lot of instances kind of dispassionately chronicling these things that happened through the course of your career, but knowing that really the guy that they thought they were writing these things to, you actually kind of pull back the layers in the course of the book. That guy really doesn't exist because it's basically this cartoon of a tabloid guy and somebody who, you know, wrote things, a lot of, you know, pushing buttons, trying to get people's attention, trying to, keep the readership high. Was there part of it at all where you were thinking it's a little bit easier not to get as worked up about this because I'm trying to push buttons and they're just responding and they're giving me what they're supposed to give?
Your analysis is very shrewd, and as a writer, it makes me feel good because it's great to talk to someone who gets it, because, you know, not everybody reads it and gets the same thing from it. But I think you're very much onto something there that, you know, you'd get this mail or these complaints and you would just think to yourself, well, I knew this would happen. I knew that I took a strong stance on, you know, last night's episode of The Sopranos or something. And I knew that not everybody's going to agree because there's a great deal of passion out there about the show. And you're right. I'm not by nature a put up your dukes kind of guy. But certainly in the writing for a pugnacious tabloid, you do affect that role. One of the best examples of this I ever read was years ago. I read a biography about Woody Allen, and it described what he's really like, what he's really been like in his career versus the nebbish, whiny, kind of like scrawny guy that he has played in public throughout his career. And that's what we think of as quote unquote Woody Allen, you know, but it's not him at all.
Right.
You know, he's an accomplished clarinetist. He's actually a pretty good basketball player. He's been a very successful rich entertainer since the 1960s. You know, he used to drive a white Rolls Royce around Manhattan. You know, this kind of stuff. So it's just interesting that you would pick up on that. Now, I never consciously put out a persona, but I think that it probably evolved over time as, you know, oh, there's that Adam Buckman guy. He's the one who's very direct in his writing and tends to, when he doesn't like something, he'll tend to bludgeon them as opposed to subtly criticize them. So it is true that I would put that kind of an image out there, but that you're right. I mean, so that someone who complained, they're complaining to a guy who's just like the guy in the newspaper, but not really the guy who just goes to work every day like everybody else and then goes home to anonymity.
Yeah, so, exactly. That was the sense that I got from it as I was reading it. By the same token, in the way that you and I keep coming back to this again, but it's because it's a very honest book when I keep using the phrase pulling back the curtain, I felt like it was kind of a brave thing on your part in terms of talking about what it was to be a tabloid guy, because again, and I've read some of your TV coverage in a non-tabloid context, and clearly you're a lot more than just being that guy playing that role. Is there any trepidation for you going forward about pulling back that curtain and talking about, okay, yeah, well, I was trying to get some reactions on The Sopranos this time and everything like that? Is there any sense that that may be something that somebody comes to misunderstand about you going forward, and that there's a lot more in your toolkit than that?
No, I think if nothing else, one of the things I'm happy about this book is, and this will answer your question in a roundabout way, is that, and I don't like to brag about this, but I'm going to anyway, everything in it is so true to the letter. I mean, I didn't have to exaggerate anything, and indeed, I think if other writers may have taken some of the stories and exaggerated them and made them even sort of worse or more extreme than they were, and I found there was really no reason to. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, in adhering very close, you know, as close as possible to the truth, I felt like the truth will just be what it is. You know, and in other words, I just laid it out there without a thought of whether people will read it and say, well, this guy is admitting right here that in these cases, when he wrote about this show or that show, he's admitting that he didn't quite feel that way when he wrote that negative column deep down in his heart. That in a way he kind of knew what would be the best column to write, but it might not reflect exactly what he honestly felt about something. And I guess I'm just trying to say, this is what journalism is. It's what column writing is. It's what human beings are when they do this. You know, and I don't think there's going to be any repercussions. I hope that people gain insights, as they would gain insights from reading any insider's account of something that they don't have access to. And on that subject, I've always felt strongly about journalism in its essence, is to take people where they can't go themselves. So to the extent that I succeed or not succeed, I'll leave others to determine, but I tried to really bring people inside the head of a TV critic at this particular time in TV history, and maybe it'll have some value, entertainment or otherwise, for people. But I must say, it's very honest. I didn't make up anything. Everything in there is documented by, like you say, the 18 loose leaf notebooks of letters, and I have 35 loose leaf notebooks of clippings that I wrote, and some tapes of interviews with some of the people that are in it, that are in the book. So, you know, whatever happens, happens. I hope people buy it. I'd like to make some money from it.
Well, yeah, and there is no embellishment in there. Again, and this is where, with your ability as a writer, what you were able to do was put the most entertaining slant on everything that happened. I always felt like I was getting the maximum chuckle that I would get out of any of these stories based on how you were telling it. You weren't having to exaggerate any, but just sometimes the understated way that it was set up, or the twist that you would put on it. But yeah, in no cases was it embellished. By the way, we should mention also too that of course your thoughts on journalism on an ongoing basis have been chronicled, of course, on the CNN show Reliable Sources, and I believe there's a number of segments out there on YouTube where folks can go check that out, and some of your past appearances there commenting on the world of journalism and how it relates to ongoing present events. One of the things from the book that I think will be most enjoyable for people is when they find anybody who is one of their favorites that you are talking about as far as an interaction with them. You mentioned in there somebody that you had greatly admired, Sid Caesar, as far as covering an event that he was at. Of course, a very, very funny story in there about William Shatner. Perhaps the name might be William Shartner, perhaps, for anybody who reads that story and sees what happened to him. And I have to say that from my own point of view on this, as somebody who was a college kid during the heyday of his show and who was really, really into it, your Morton Downey Jr. stuff in there is what really made me sit up and take notice. And I, of course, envied you for the opportunity to get to talk to him, to know him, I guess, about as well as anybody possibly could, because when you're talking about it in there, it's always a thing of, like, what's real and what's the illusion. But whether it be Mort or any other number of folks in there, it's some really interesting anecdotes about what they were like.
Well, here's the point of that approach, Rick. There are those people who have covered an industry or, you know, a single beat in their whole life, such as, you know, politics, or maybe it's the movie business or the music business. For example, one of my old former coworkers from the New York Post is a rock columnist named Lisa Robinson, and she just wrote a book that's selling really well. It's her memoirs of covering, you know, the rock music world from a very young age in the early 70s to the present, and she drops a lot of names because indeed she became on first name basis with, you know, Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and everybody else who she got to cover. And I guess there are some people who have covered television as long as I have who maybe formed closer relationships with more stars. But here again, I wanted to be honest in the sense of I'm just a guy. I wasn't planning to meet this one or meet that one. The people that I interacted with over the years really, really ran the gamut. And that's why I have an entire section of a chapter about Morton Downey Jr., who most people I don't think remember today. He was a big, important figure in the 1980s with an outrageous talk show, as you know, Rick. And the reason he's in it is because materials I have related to my conversations with him just happened to survive. Like, my final phone call with him happened to be on tape, and I still have it. So I thought, well, you know, others might pick or try to say that they knew Oprah Winfrey or something. Well, I say in the book, I covered TV for 30 years and met her once, and she barely made an impression on me at all. But a guy like Morton Downey, he made a bigger impression than Oprah Winfrey. And in a way, that's the nature of the business. You know, as you know, the celebrities, you know, or the figures, the people I met range from, you know, Mr. Rogers to Mr. T. You know, it's just a very weird situation. You don't plan to meet these people, but they just enter your life and then they leave. And you don't become friends with them. But you can have some fun with them, and you can learn how interesting show business is by just taking a look at all of them. And I hope that people will learn something from the chapters. I mean, one of the chapters is called Cavalcade of Stars, and it's really meant to be really varied, you know. It doesn't spend too much time on any one kind of person. It's game show hosts and actors and talk show hosts and just about everybody.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the things people will enjoy most about this book is that I got the sense of it almost kind of being a time capsule where you're reading it and it kind of takes you back to that moment in time and what these celebrities were like in their heyday. And yeah. I have to tell you, like on the Morton Downey thing, back when I was in college and, like I said, a big fan of the show, working a summer job the one year, that there was some kind of, I don't remember the exact nature of it, there was a competition and it was going to be airfare to go to a vacation spot, airfare within reason, I guess. I don't think they would have flown me to Cape Town, South Africa. But when I put down where I wanted to go, it was Secaucus, New Jersey, and I was asked why. I said, that's where the Morton Downey Jr. show is at. I want to be in the audience. You know?
That's great.
Such was it hooked into me back at the time. So it was really great to read that. And again, the book does a great job of talking about the strong emotions that are evoked by entertainment, by television. And I have to say, I might have been one of these folks. I hope it wouldn't have been hate mail I would have been writing, but I would have considered writing something strongly worded back in 97 if I were a reader of the Post at the time. Your thing about Seinfeld I found to be very interesting, and again, bringing up the notion that the column may have had something, and again, to your credit, you're not overstating it, you're just saying...
Yeah.
It may have had something to do with Jerry Seinfeld's mental place as far as when it was time to pull the plug on the show. Of course, I thought season 9 was outstanding, and you mentioned a couple of episodes specifically. I have to tell you, my all-time favorite by far is The Voice. I actually just rewatched it on Crackle the other day. I love the Craig Barrett Industries subplot. That one is my numero uno one, so I can see where, again, you might have been getting some strong opinions at the time if you were thinking that Seinfeld's show might have been losing it a bit at the beginning of season 9.
Well, what you're talking about is, of course, 3 weeks into season 9, the New York Post television section, when I was editor, put we published an innocuous poll of our readers, this kind of thing where they were supposed to clip it out and fax it to us, because the fax machine was the technology of the day, and tell us if they thought Seinfeld was not as good as it had been for 8 seasons. And, you know, in retrospect, the Cremerica Industries episode with, you know, the intern and everything was a terrific episode. And, you know, and George was working for Playnow Industries. And,
yep.
You know, it just, in retrospect, sure, it's fine. And at the time, though, we felt like, gee whiz, this seems like the same old thing with Seinfeld. And that's the other thing I wanted to bring out in the book, is that when you're working in daily newspapers, you have to feed the thing every day. So you have to have ideas coming out of your ears, you know. So on that particular day, we thought, let's raise some conversation about Seinfeld. And so we put this blank, like, in the paper and said, you know, write your opinion. Is Seinfeld going downhill or something? And to our amazement, Jerry Seinfeld himself called the editor-in-chief to try to stop the Post from publishing the results of this idiotic poll that coming weekend. And the editor wouldn't let him get away with that. He said, no, we have to run it because, you know, we already told the readers we'll run the results. And he convinced Jerry to do an interview with one of our reporters. And so we got an interview with Jerry that we ran next to the poll results. I don't even know what the poll results were. I think it was about even. You know something, Rick? We were lucky if we got 80 responses. You know, I mean, it was meaningless. But what you're referring to is that a few months later, this thing ran in October, a few months later, Jerry did make the famous Christmas Day announcement that Seinfeld would end that spring. And then he gave an interview to Time magazine where he said he made the decision because he wanted to get off stage on a high note when he was still number one and the show was still good. And he understood that there were some critics in a few places beginning to sort of take a second look at the show and not enjoying it as much as before. Whether he was referring to the New York Post TV section, I have no idea, but it is true that I don't remember anyone else criticizing it at the time. I just remember us doing it. So there are those who are saying maybe the Post had a role in convincing Jerry that this was the time to get off stage at that high note. If that's the case, I certainly don't feel great if I helped drive Jerry Seinfeld off of TV, but all things being equal, maybe it was the time for it to go. And as we know, the episodes that we're left with are some of the most, as a 9-season television show, they're the finest shows that were ever made. So, you know, maybe had he stuck around another 2-3 seasons, you know, Jerry would have had to have married Elaine and have a child and all this kind of stuff, and it just wouldn't have worked. So,
yeah. There's two ways of looking at it. Again, yeah, if the most important thing to him was leave behind something that's completely immortal, then he did get out at the right time. And having said that, again, just like selfishly, I would have rather had 19 years of Seinfeld, even if it lapsed into stuff that wasn't quite as funny or whatever. I think the fans would have probably preferred a bigger catalog, even if the quality wasn't quite at that part. But that's not
that
how
could be. I mean, it was much beloved. It was hard to say goodbye to. But all things being equal, it's just like how it's just how the world turns in a way. I mean, so Seinfeld ended in 1998. It was a product and a cultural high point of the 1990s. How it might have looked today or in 2005 when television was beginning to change and become much more permissive. You know, it's not for nothing that in a way the follow-up show to Seinfeld was Curb Your Enthusiasm. And the fact that I mean, different characters, obviously, and everything, but, you know, by the co-creator, Larry David, and it's no evolutionary coincidence that he kind of took ideas that had been germinated on Seinfeld and made them even more extreme and brought it to the only channel that could air this kind of stuff, which was HBO. So what would the Jerry Seinfeld approach to sitcoms have been like when it was suddenly going to start to be compared to all the other things that began to happen in the 2000s. So in a way, you know, Jerry was shrewd. You know, Andy Griffith did the same thing. You know, he got out when he was number one. And few people have that opportunity. Jay Leno did it. There's still some debate about whether that was voluntary or not, but nevertheless, he did it, like his friend Jerry did. So, You know, I'm sure Jerry's okay with it. I think he was tired of it as much as anything.
Well, and it's interesting, again, from having watched the little mini reunion that they did on Curb a few years back, of seeing what Seinfeld will look like in the modern world, because Seinfeld, again, being so much a product of its time, you rarely saw anything on there even about cell phones or the Internet or anything like that, even though those things were starting to bubble up in the 90s.
Yeah.
You really didn't see it there. So you got a little bit of a glimpse of what it would look like at that point a few years back, and it was a very interesting perspective. But towards the end of your book here, you get into some thoughts on what you had, in your opinion, seen as sort of the last great TV season that we've had to this point, June to September 2007. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be very intriguing, because that's not long before this whole Great Recession that really just kind of, to me, I have felt kind of culturally even more so than 9/11. That's sort of been more of a before and after point. Maybe that comes from not being in New York, but it just seems like, again, for how long it's taken this country to pull out of that, it seems like 2007, 2008 are very remote. And I was thinking about this recently when I was watching Outsourced on Hulu Plus, and I watched the entire season of that. I only watched a few episodes at a time. That was, of course, in 2010, and I'm struck by this. I had said to somebody recently that even 4 years later, I don't think you could make that show now. And again, and I'm not trying to make a political point when I say the age of Obama, but this sense now of how rapidly things are changing in this country, and if you use the term the Washington Redskins, someone will accuse you of perpetrating genocide. Do you really get the sense that we've kind of seen a sea change culturally the last couple of years, and that standards for, I don't necessarily want to say political correctness, but more or less like in that direction of making sure we don't offend whatever groups? I get the sense that you, while in terms of generalized profanity, generalized things like that, the whole thing of going after what might be deemed to be protected groups of people, I get the sense there's a lot less leeway today.
I completely agree. The cultural changes wrought by I guess in the world we're talking about, just to narrow it down to television first, you have this distribution system for video content, the Internet, that has changed everything so much that, to me, the big difference culturally is that suddenly there's no barriers to anything you can show or talk about or say or do on television. It's beyond belief the kinds of violence and sex and nudity and profanity that is on almost every kind of television now. Yeah, you could say it hasn't quite reached the proportions on, say, a CBS as it has, say, on FX, but it's almost there. And to me, that's the biggest cultural change. And it's only 2014. 2007 was 7 years ago. But you're right, it might as well have been 1992 or something. Look, the reason I named my final chapter The Last Great Season was really two reasons. One was, to me, the spring, summer, and fall of that year where there were four or five shows that really I thought were a great collection of shows on different channels, and they premiered at different weird times, like, you know, July and August and June and this kind of thing, was meant to convey that there really were no seasons by that time anyway. That season, so-called, was what I made of it. And I called it a season because it was a grouping of shows on various networks that I happened to like and kind of came at around the same time. And I'm talking about the finale of The Sopranos and the beginning of Mad Men, and I guess there was a season of Dexter, and there was Ken Burns' great documentary about World War II. So, but after that, I noticed within myself a sort of lessening of interest in the new shows that were coming along. And I've had this argument ever since the book came out with some people who say, Adam, how can you say that was the last great season? Because since then we've had, you know, Game of Thrones and Sons of Anarchy and Fargo on FX. And I just say, you know what? I guess it's because I spent almost 30 years watching television shows, and these things that everybody's crowing about to me are just like watching, you know, grindhouse cinema. You know, it's just like watching like Quentin Tarantino's children, you know. It's just, yeah, I know that there's a lot of cinematic values to Game of Thrones, and I know that some of the shows are very well made. But I don't think people today are really looking closely at what they're absorbing night after night. I wrote a blog post not long ago for my blog, TVHal.com, that just said, you know what? For the last couple of days, I've been watching some DVDs of some shows that have come my way, and one of them was Fargo, and I think there was a Sons of Anarchy DVD from FX. And the only commonality to the shows today, everybody was getting their heads blown off. I mean, it was really gory stuff. And to sit there as a critic day after day after day watching this stuff, it takes a toll. So, yes, the last couple of years, maybe it's been since the Obama administration, something you can't blame him for, but just a cultural coincidence. Television is like a free-for-all. And you're right, it changes every year or two. Like the stuff that was trendy a few years ago would look like it was from the 1980s or something today.
Sure.
It's very fast. You talk about shows that, like you were talking about how Seinfeld is interesting on one level where, you know, the people on the show interact in a personal way. They're not on social media and they don't have devices in their hands or anything like that. I've been watching some of the sitcoms coming up this fall, and they're all about social media, every single one. Every young character is clinging to their phones and Facebooking each other and all the rest of it. It's just a really, really different world. And I'm 54. I'm on the outer edge of the demographic group that television wants to reach. In a few months, I won't be there anymore. And it's really true. It's really true. The shows are not for me, you know. So
it is a changing world. It's hard to get a grip on, you know, what they're able to do. And, you know, you've talked about how anything goes today in terms of violence. And I have to say, even on the shows that I really, really treasure, and I would certainly count Fargo in there, Justified, certainly Breaking Bad would be a good example of that as well. The ones that I treasure the most do certainly have that, I must admit. But
one of the things I was conflicted with in the book, you know, understanding that this stuff is violent and not necessarily virtuous, I soaked it up anyway, you know.
Exactly, you know, and so that kind of stuff is off limits now, and yet there are just other things, and this was a movie rather than TV, but I think the point still stands too. Whenever I catch a rerun of Ricky Bobby on TV, for the gay stuff that was in there, for anything that could be termed homophobic, could that movie be made exactly the way it was today? You know, outsourced. Oh, too many Indian stereotypes. I mean, it's a show that was built around Indian stereotypes, frankly.
Yeah.
I would find it hard to see it getting green-lighted only 4 years later. So our sensibilities seem to be a little
point.
Bit more delicate in some areas.
You make a good point about that. And certainly, I won't be the first one to say, you know, you couldn't make... You know, and this is ancient history, like you couldn't make All in the Family today.
Oh, sure.
You know, the casual way that Carol O'Connor used racial epithets would have particularly younger viewers raised on in educated and politically correct college campuses over the last generation, they would probably have heart attacks or something, you know, if they heard something like that. And you're right. I think, look, my own personal opinion, maybe it's because of the age I am, people are entirely too hypersensitive about what others may think. It's sort of like with the Washington Redskins controversy. It's almost like a lot of people are speaking for Indians. You know what I mean? They're saying, well, the Indians must be upset. And, well, if they are, then let them say they are. You know what I mean? It's just like, what do you know about? Maybe Indians never gave it a moment's thought. You know, they're living their life wherever they live. You know, they're not thinking about, oh, the Washington football team. I wish it wasn't called the Redskins. It's really chapping my hide or something. You know, they don't care. You know, I don't think they care.
Well, right. Right, right. I mean, you know, it's not a monolith in terms of opinion. I think we make this mistake a lot of times. And I know that some of my friends a lot of times when talking about it, as far as something that's in the news recently here, as far as Israel and supporting Israel, and I always make the point to people that I certainly do, but, you know, Likud is not a monolith over there. There is a spectrum of opinion in Israel about what's the best way to handle things. So I think the same thing can be said of Native Americans here. You might even have a majority that are against the term the Washington Redskins, but I'd be shocked if it was even 70 or 80%.
Yeah, and it infiltrates all these other things, like, is it okay to celebrate Columbus Day? Well, I don't know. I mean, no one has ever known what Columbus Day is. You know, when I was a child, Columbus Day would come around, and sometimes we had off of school, and sometimes we didn't. I guess we were celebrating the discovery of the New World.
Sure.
That's a thing. You know, I don't know if it's true that because Columbus showed up, everyone who was here then died. I think it's a lot more complicated. And I think there's a lack of education about all sorts of things. And I guess I make this speech in my head a lot and sometimes bore my friends and acquaintances with it. But where it comes to politically correct speech and people thinking that this one's going to be offended by that and all the rest of it, I think you can't make everybody love, like make everybody on earth love the Jews, for example. You know, like I'm a Jew. Okay, I'm Jewish.
Sure.
And you can't make them all accept homosexuality. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's always going to be some people, they're not on board with it. And is that really harmful to homosexuals if different parts of the country just don't care for it? Or their religion, it's not part of it. This is a country that's supposed to be tolerant of everything.
Right.
But there are certain people who can't tolerate it if it's directed against them. Look, no one says, well, if someone exercises their dislike of homosexuality by physically attacking homosexuals, well, that's not right because that goes against criminal statutes. You're not supposed to assault people. So, but just to have a thought that, you know what, I don't care for gay people. I don't care for some gay people. You know, this idea that you're supposed to just love everyone is unrealistic. And I just find that if people would step back and say, you know what, what's the harm if the guy down the street doesn't care for homosexuals? As long as he's not beating us with a baseball bat, I don't care what he likes, you know, gender biases and all the rest of it.
I think we have
a pretty democratic country these days. I mean, our
small d, sure,
our gridlocked government notwithstanding, but I mean in terms of, you know, for the most part, equal opportunities and all kinds of stuff. You know, I think
exactly.
We made it, you know. Anyway, that's my speech on that. It runs far afield from television.
Well, to bring it full circle, Adam, I mean, I think your book does an excellent job covering this time in America coming up to it. We're sort of talking about the time after your book. That's sort of where we took it to in our last couple of minutes. But your book does an excellent job, I think, of tracing what pop culture, entertainment, television was like going through, you know, really the end of that last era, if you consider it to be 2007, 2008, maybe the beginning of 2009. And basically, again, coinciding with your time at the New York Post, a great, great book, Jerk, How I Wasted My Life Watching Television. And as I say, I knew it was going to be truly outstanding and a great conversation breaking it down. And by the way, folks, you should also look forward to, in the near future, friends of ours in the 21st Century Media Alliance, not just another TV site, I understand they have proffered an invitation to Adam to discuss the book there as well. So I'm sure it'll be from a different angle and some other great points hit. So if you want to learn even more about the book, that would be a great opportunity in terms of getting different perspectives on it as well. But from my perspective, I really enjoyed it as always. Adam, I knew that it would. I'm so glad you finished the book. I'm so glad that it came out the way that it did, as I knew that it would. And again, as I knew it would be, really great to discuss it with you today. All the best. I certainly hope it does well, because nobody deserves it more than you.
Rick, I just want to thank you for the amazing support you've given me the last few years. It means a lot. And let's do it again, okay?
I appreciate that. Thank you, Adam. I mean, you're somebody that I look up to for everything that you have accomplished, and as this book really kind of chronicles. So that means a lot to hear that from you. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great evening.
Thank you very much. You too, Adam. And thank you all, everybody, for tuning in today to this mini-episode of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IAmBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time
Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.